Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Jaca. If you're listening to this live on September 25th, then that means that it is Pledge Week. That is a week where we ask people to donate. If you love what we do here at Radio K, especially if you love this podcast, definitely donate and let people know about us and let us know that you love us. This year, Pledge is radioactive themed, so we're going to bring you some Radio K stories, some radio stories, and some radioactive stories. All that and more starts right now on Real College Podcast. When we were designing Radio K's radioactive pledge theme, we hammed up the stereotypes. Our website is covered in green slime, the spots we play on air are inspired by Spider-Man and the Cold War PSAs. But there's more to being radioactive than nukes and Geiger counters. Radioactive materials aren't all that scary anymore, and they're everywhere, from hospitals to construction sites. They're even on our campus. Reporter Emily Allen sat down with some professionals in the Health and Safety Department to talk about the ways the U of M gets radioactive.
There are geology labs that use isotopes. There are a lot of labs in the health science community here that use isotopes.
And in the hospital.
That's Jacqueline Newhall, a radiation safety technician in the Department of Health and Safety at the U. You can also hear Bryce Armstrong in the back. He's a health physicist in radiation protection.
Pretty much any research lab could have a use for radioactive materials in it. Most of them are very small amounts and done for imaging of various parts of the cell that they want to see where things go.
Bryce and Jacqueline say that anyone who comes into contact with radioactive materials has to go through training. This goes beyond researchers and medical students to include facilities and management staff who might need to access a room where radioactive materials were present.
There's an initial training that discusses safety, so people can feel comfortable using radioactive materials in their lab. And there are numerous policies in place about how to set up the lab and how to work with them and how to keep yourself safe while conducting your research.
Mm-hmm. And there's an additional online training for the users that goes more into the safety of actually using the radioactive materials. And then after they've done that initially, everybody that uses materials will have an annual refresher that's done in person by one of our auditors, too.
The U of M isn't the only school with radioactive materials. Bryce says most large schools and hospitals are right there with us in terms of materials and regulation.
The training and the licensing for radioactive materials is pretty much the same from state to state. There's a lot of states that are regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Minnesota is an agreement state, so we're regulated by our Minnesota Department of Health. And they are the same rules as you would have with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So everybody has to follow the same rules, the same regulations. And they get inspected on, depending on the license type, they'll get inspected either from every year to every 4 years.
Most of the people who actually use radioactive materials are in the medical school or they're researchers. Bryce and Jacqueline say the undergraduate students don't usually come into contact with radioactive materials.
If you work for the department itself as an undergrad, that's what I did. You're in the unique situation of getting to go around and handle and kind of transport, deliver and dispose of these materials.
That's Megan Clark, an exception to the undergrad rule. Megan's a radiation waste technician who started this job about 3.5 to 4 years ago.
When I was initially hired on, it was just me and another guy. Over the years, I now have, 3 people on my team, so a total of 4 of the waste technicians. And then we also have, 3 of the survey technicians? So it's a fairly large team of students who kind of go around and help with the daily going-ons of the department.
Megan talks about the different ways waste technicians have to dispose of radioactive materials based on their states.
So for example, solid waste, we just compact it into drums, and then those are sent off from our facilities to, I suppose, like an area where they hold this waste. And that's for like long half-life. For short half-life, we actually take care of those, and eventually it comes to a point where the isotopes will decay out, and then they can just be treated as like a general sort of waste. So it really just sort of depends on what you're working with.
Megan also talks about the equipment waste technicians get to work with and what they have to wear on the job.
Typically, we just wear lab coats and gloves. That's going to protect you from a majority of what we work with. Depending on the type of processing you're doing, we'll wear waterproof aprons, kind of longer gloves. We'll wear face masks, boots, and stuff like that. But it's pretty general.
My favorite piece of equipment is this item here that Bryce and Jacqueline introduce.
Okay, this is a Geiger-Müller meter. It's the radiation survey meter that you'll see in movies all the time where they're carrying around a box in one hand and a pancake probe in the other hand, and they're surveying for radiation. So that's exactly what we're using here.
So I have this pancake probe just out in the air, and you can hear a couple intermittent clicks. And that's normal. Hear anything except a couple clicks. But when I hold it up to the check source here, that means there's radiation.
I think a lot of people get very kind of spooked about radiation, when in reality, if it's like properly managed, if you're trained well enough on it, it's really not like a huge kind of detrimental factor. It can be very helpful. It has a lot of like really good uses. So maybe just be a little less afraid of these posted areas because it's being well taken care of.
For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Emily Allen.
In 2010, the Local Community Radio Act granted equal protection to low-power FM radio stations and regular broadcasters. This made new licenses available for LPFMs, as the low-power stations are known. This was a big deal because low-power stations had been prohibited from forming for the past 10 years on the basis that they might interfere with the broadcast of larger stations. With this change in regulation, new community radio stations have been able to start up all across the country. St. Paul's WFNU Frogtown station is one of them. Here's reporter Liv Riggins with more on what it's like to run a budding community radio station and why stations that broadcast super locally matter.
Think about when you look out your window into your neighborhood and you like watch a squirrel, or you like look at your neighbor parking weird. Just like give that two more feet and that like two more blocks, that's your neighborhood. And like people really care about what's going on in their neighborhoods. People really care about what's going on in their town. Like,
that's Simona Zappas, director of WFNU, Frogtown's community radio station, talking about localism. One of the several neighborhood stations that sprang up after the 2010 change in FCC radio regulations, WFNU is a mainly volunteer-run project of the Frogtown Neighborhood Association. In contrast to channels on streaming services or satellite radio, where a station might have a single genre or even a single artist's theme, WFNU doesn't have a specific focus, other than getting the broadest range of programming possible. Volunteers ideally are from Frogtown or have a tie to the area, but that's the only criteria for getting active in the radio station. And that makes for some really interesting and truly diverse radio, all within a 10-mile broadcasting radius.
Localism can include a lot more identities than people think. In Frogtown, for example, just that neighborhood is incredibly diverse. There's a lot of recent immigrants. There's a lot of people who've been in the neighborhood for three generations. You can encompass a lot of people. When you're into these like higher media groups, the bubble of who's telling the story is getting a lot smaller. Most of the people who work for NPR, they're just folks from elite colleges. That makes the bubble even smaller, makes just the racial representation a lot smaller, makes the gender representation a lot smaller, makes the class representation and class background representation a lot smaller. Our first show was called Real Talk with Real Brothers, and it was just two guys who live in the neighborhood who are both hilarious, like really charismatic, great guys. They host nights at bars around the Twin Cities. We have shows that do live mixes of club music. We have shows that are really focused on local music. We have a show that's folks who are just recovering addicts, and they talk about their experiences in recovery. And I think that that's a really cool way to kind of change how radio can be used as a resource, just to let people share that experience and hopefully help one person who might be struggling. There needs to be able to be this chance to give a platform for speech for this. Everybody has an idea. Everybody has something to say. And it's also just about, it's about making way for weirdness. It's about like letting there be just like that show when you flip on your cable access channel at night, that's like a guy doing gymnastics in his house. Like, we need that. We need people doing stuff like that. We can't just let radio just be homogenous. And it can't only be telling one story. It can't only be telling a story of like one class or one race. Like, there needs to be this opportunity. Radio can be pretty cheap to produce if it's just about having a microphone and getting the voice out. There was never anything that said that media had to only be produced by this small group. There's lots of ways to make it, lots of chances to do it. There's like a station in Hawaii that like most of their programs are about turtles, which like, hell yeah, that's what I want to listen to. I'm so sick of experts. Experts like exist in the smallest world, and I don't like them.
This sentiment isn't uncommon. America's trust in the mass media and in institutions has dropped to its lowest level since 1972, when Gallup polling began asking that question.
Right now, there's kind of like this crisis for authenticity in the news. And you just can't really get more real than community radio. You can hear the microphone, you can hear the means of production, you can actually hear the people doing the process of doing it. It's like you're actually like experiencing and feeling the medium. I mean, the thing is, community radio, because of the price, it allows people to not be beholden to corporate interests, and it's money and corporations that really have a stake in warping the truth, basically.
The hyperlocal scale and not-for-profit nature of community stations like WFNU, KALY, KRSM, KFAI, or any other small radio station means there's not the incentive to spin things, either for personal profit or for the benefit of a big donor. Like it or not, it's people's actual opinions and perspectives. Nobody's in it for the money when there's one staff member for the whole station.
On our staff, it's me. But basically all of our programming is produced by volunteers.
While volunteers have a lot of different reasons for being active in the community station, there's an added benefit to being involved. Free job training.
We give people equipment and training for free, just on how to have a radio show, how to work the equipment, how to get this all together, and then a chance to actually have a platform to do it and build a portfolio. It might be something that someone's been really passionate about their whole life or interested in or excited about, but platforms like this are really hard to come by, and there's a really big opportunity gap with a lot of factors for what brings people into doing radio. The Twin Cities, they're pretty infamous at this point for having the largest opportunity gap in the nation, having the largest income gap. There is like a really strong media justice community here. There's a really strong foundation and nonprofit community here. One of the reasons why there's a really strong community about this here is because there's a really strong need. For as nice it is that this does feel like everybody knows each other here and that we have these strong communities, there's a goal that these communities need to work towards.
And Zappas sees WFNU and other similar stations as platforms that are uniquely suited to facilitate the work of reaching for that big ideal of equal opportunity.
That's kind of my secret goal for the station. I want to create best practices for interviewing that's based in restorative justice and making people feel safe and like that can ultimately be healing, or like that interviews don't have to just have a goal of sharing information. When I learned how to work production equipment, or when I had an opportunity to kind of share my story on college radio, which is where I got started, it was incredible to be able to be validated, or actually rather that I was able to validate myself by having this opportunity to tell my story, that I then had the skills to do it. There is a chance to really to empower the voices that profit just bulldozes. I think that like community media is the only place that something like that could happen. This is about like the community that is producing and the community that is listening.
I'm Liv Friggins for Radio K's Real College Podcast. Roughly 20% of the United States' power comes from nuclear power, a source that promotes itself as more environmentally friendly than coal and gas. But with nuclear power comes nuclear waste. Alex Schumacher looked into the Prairie Island nuclear plant and its relationship with the nearby communities.
Roughly an hour south of the Twin Cities lies one of Minnesota's two nuclear power plants, the Prairie Island Power Plant. The plant lies less than a mile from the Prairie Island Indian Community, a reservation for the Metoquantan Indians. The Metoquantan regard Prairie Island as a spiritual place, and as a whole, the reservation has 960 members. But due to the limited space on Prairie Island, only about a quarter of the reservation's members can actually live in the reservation. The reservation also hosts the Treasure Island Casino, which draws in a lot of people outside the local community. There are only two roads on and off the island, but one is in public, meaning that really there's only one way off the island that's accessible to the general public. Across both these roads lie train tracks operated by the Canadian Pacific Railway, meaning whenever a train passes through, cutting off access to both roads, the island essentially is cut off. The Prairie Island Power Plant is run by the Xcel Energy Company, and Xcel and the tribal community's relations over the years have at times been oppositional. But according to the community statement on their website and information sent to me by Eric Cahill, a spokesperson for the Prairie Island Tribal Council, the community's opposition isn't to nuclear power as a whole, but rather to the storage of nuclear waste on Prairie Island. As of 2016, 1.9 million pounds of nuclear waste is being temporarily stored in 39 dry casket containers on Prairie Island, according to Eric Pahill. However, currently there is no permanent place to put the nuclear waste, which isn't Xcel's fault. In 1982, Congress passed the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, which required the U.S. federal government to develop a permanent nuclear waste storage site. In 1987, it was added to the act that Yucca Mountain in Nevada would become the nation's permanent nuclear storage site. However, as of now, that site doesn't exist. There's no place to put the nuclear waste. Between lawsuits, controversies, and lapses in funding between different administrations, the U.S. still has no permanent storage site for nuclear waste, leaving Xcel, other energy companies, and the surrounding communities in a limbo of temporary storage. For their part, Xcel says the Prairie Island plant was designed to withstand both floods and tornadoes were either to ever affect the plant, according to an NPR News article about Minnesota's nuclear power plants. Moreover, studies by the EPA and the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission have both shown that the Prairie Island plant hasn't had an impact on either the water, soil, or vegetation surrounding the plant since it was built in 1974. Plant operators are also required to undergo simulations every 6 weeks. Plant also works with local law enforcement to train in case of an emergency, according to an NPR article. In terms of its relationship with the Native community, Xcel says that it has quarterly meetings with tribal council members, and beyond those, works to keep in touch with the tribe on matters regarding the plant's operation. I traveled down to Prairie Island with a car full of RCP reporters to find out what people in the area thought of the plant.
Well, it's been there a long time, and I don't see any problems yet.
Oh, 100% safe. They've got so many backup mechanisms to that plant, it's not even funny. So, hell, a coal plant is much more dangerous to the environment and the people. I think the nearest coal plant is up in, where is it, Joe? The big one, Becker. You know, I think it's 100% safe. Look at Europe. Europe is almost all run by nuclear power, and they don't have the CO2 problem we have. I think it's really one of the pieces to the total answer to get off of these carbon-based fuels. So, but I understand. I'd be probably concerned even if they told me it was 100% safe. I'd probably, if it was in my backyard, I'd probably think, what's up? It's probably not safe. I know they are storing nuclear waste there, which they shouldn't be doing. It's unfortunate that they couldn't do something with the nuclear waste.
With no permanent storage site for the nuclear waste, Xcel is going to have to keep building more temporary dry caskets, and the amount of waste on Prairie Island will continue to grow and grow and grow. I owe a huge thanks to Liv, Ben, Anthony, and Lou for giving up their Friday night to come down with me to Prairie Island. Thank you all so much. It really meant a lot that you would come down with me. And from Real College Podcast, I'm Alex Schumacher.
With Pledge Week here, I figured it'd be nice to talk to somebody who is still doing radio but started at Radio K. I was able to get in touch with Sarah Bowden and talk to her about what it is she does and how Radio K played a role in that. I started out by asking her what her job here at Radio K was.
I was primarily, back then we had a news department. I don't think you guys have that anymore. And then that dissolved and that became the arts and culture department. And so basically, I was a reporter and a producer, and I was also managing editor of a show called Culture Q. Do you guys still have Culture Q?
Right. So Culture Q has become Real College Podcast, so that's what I'm in charge of now.
Oh, I was you. I did your job.
Oh, awesome. It's always nice to hear people who worked in this same job.
Yeah, it's kind of surreal to like have you call me on this number. I remember spending lots of really late evenings editing pieces because for a while the show was on a Saturday morning. And this was before Culture Q, so I'd be like at Radio K really super late. And there's this guy that used to call the number that we're talking on now, and I don't know what his deal was. He might have been like crazy drunk. But he would like call, and he would like talk about really weird things that I don't quite remember. But it was always like, I don't know, I picked up the phone because, like, I was waiting for him to, like, I don't know, give me some kind of crazy scoop, and that never happened.
What would you say was one of your favorite things about working or even volunteering at Radio K?
Well, radio was always something I really enjoyed listening to growing up. I grew up in Wisconsin, and my dad's house was in the country, and we didn't have cable, and this was like in the early 2000s, so there was only, we only had like really slow dial-up internet or something, so I listened to a lot of radio, and I really liked it, and it was just really exciting to get to be on the radio and tell stories and talk to interesting people. And I was always kind of an oddball at Radio K because everybody was really into music, and it's not that I don't like music, but I was always more into, like, reporting and storytelling, and so there's kind of, like, this goofy little group within Radio K that I really felt like I really enjoyed those people and made some really wonderful friends that I still talk to today and keep in touch with.
Do you have a most fond memory at Radio K? Or like a favorite story that you reported while you were here?
Yeah. I did a story on this guy who had pet squirrels at the St. Kate's campus. And this was just kind of like a throwaway story that I didn't take very seriously. but it ended up being like everyone's favorite story I ever did. And people would, it was called Squirrel Man, and people would bring up Squirrel Man. And I was kind of embarrassed by the story because, like, I want to do, like, you know, I want to do what I guess I'm doing now, which is like serious journalism where you're telling stories about changing people's lives and like weighty, taking on really weighty public policy issues or whatever. Everyone just loved this man's story about this guy, and I had like tape of him like throwing nuts at a squirrel and calling a squirrel, and this girl on the campus like kind of scolding this guy, and he's like, she's like, you trained those squirrels to like talk to people. I don't quite remember. It was like a really long time ago, but I felt like it was just fun to create something that got such a strong reaction from people, even though it wasn't quite what I was looking for.
Yeah, we have Emily, who's one of our producers for the show. She just did a piece like this past semester about like a chicken rescue place that they rescue like urban chickens. And like, it's the story everybody refers to. We're always like, whenever I'm trying to like think of like weird things that we've covered, I'm like, well, there's the chicken story. And it's just like, it's the infamous story of our time right now, which I'm sure the squirrel one was of your time, too. So why don't you tell me a little bit about what it is that you do now and how you think some of the skills you gained here at Radio K transferred over.
Yeah, so today I'm a public radio reporter. I'm a reporter at Iowa Public Radio, which, you know, being a public radio reporter is my dream job. And I didn't actually think I'd be able to ever do something like this. And I do. And I think it all really started at Radio K. A lot of reporters I know, especially when they're starting out, have a hard time making their deadlines, and that was never a problem for me. And I think that's because I spent so many super late nights at Radio K writing and making sure things would be ready to go, editing, voicing into like, you know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. Do you guys still have that nasty bean bag in the record closet?
Yeah, I think the videography people have that now. It's theirs, and I've been told don't sit on it because it's kind of gross.
Yeah, that was the thing when we were there, don't sit on it. I didn't sleep on that beanbag, but, like, some of my reporters would. I would, like, kind of just, like, lay on the floor and take a nap, but spent, like, a lot of time. And so I felt when, you know, I eventually started, you know, reporting for Statewide Network or, you know, sometimes I report for NPR. It's not that there weren't hiccups, and there's definitely, like, things I had to learn to get better at, but just, like, I never doubted the fact that I could hold a microphone, get good tape, and then write a script because I'd done it, you know, 100 times at Radio K. So when I got into the real world, I just felt really prepared. And I would not have my career without Radio K.
So what advice do you have for people as far as, like, making the best of their time here?
Get a lot of clips. Get a lot of clips everywhere. Get clips at Radio K. Get clips through all your internships. If there's work that's even sort of related to journalism or radio journalism, you should take it. Honestly, I think that you should also consider writing for the school newspaper because reporting is reporting, and journalists today need to know how to take pictures and do multimedia and write for the web. And then also, I think it's really important to be easy to work with. Really, really talented people who are prima donnas and can't make their deadlines and have an attitude don't get far in the industry, because anyone who, you know, gets the interview or gets the internship, you're already talented. But if you want to stand out, you also have to be easy to work with. And that doesn't mean being a doormat, but that means, again, hitting your deadlines, following directions, taking your work seriously.
Thank
that is all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already donated, head over to RadioK.org and hit that big green button. Donate a little bit, donate a lot, do whatever you can. Every dollar counts, and it really means a lot to us. You can hear all of our previous episodes at RadioK.org/Real College Podcast. You can also subscribe on iTunes. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Alex Schumacher, Emily Allen, and Liv Friggin. I'm your host and managing editor, Jacob Maldonado Medina. Thank you for listening, and tune in every Monday at 6:30 for arts and culture coverage.